The following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One. Don't forget to download our new Podcast One app.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
Put your name on it. Just put your name on it. That's all I say. Be a man or a woman. Put your name on it.
Well, I'd like to hear about it, pothead.
Look at the game change.
If you want to battle, it's either that you will or
you
won't.
You know, you're not a bad looking man, Mr. Gals.
But you are, Blanche. You are in that chair.
Bullshit. You didn't convince me. Let me see your real war face.
No, I thought you said that you are right, Spider.
Hey, man.
Four stories.
Hi, everybody. Jay Moore here. It's going to be hot today. So hot. Hooters girls are coming by. Scott Husing, you wrote a book. All right. More stories. Scott Husing is here. He wrote Echo in Ramadi, the first-hand story of U.S. Marines in Iraq's deadliest city. Usually, Scott, first of all, hello, sir.
Thanks for having me.
I love you on the Break It Down show, and now you're a guest host with Petey. And our buddy John. Usually when I read a book, I take like copious notes and there's things I want to refer to. This thing was so all-encompassing that it was almost like the longest day where I didn't really have it would be a fool's errand to try to actually go bullet point through Echo and Ramadi and like cherry pick what I wanted to talk to you about. So I'm going to take very broad strokes here and hopefully you can fill in the blanks because it's hard to believe this happened to a guy, let alone a guy I'm sitting with, let alone it's not fiction. I don't know how else to put it. It was really overwhelming at times. Weird things, like the guy getting a bullet ricocheted off his helmet and just getting like a concussion next to a fucking water truck. I'm like, oh my, it's so real and crackling with life. It's, I don't know, it's powerful. I put my name on it. So everybody go buy it. It's at jmoore.com. So anyway, how long did it take you to write this?
11 years.
11 years?
Well...
Did you graduate high school, or...?
Well, do you want that story, or you want how long it took
me to write?
No,
I'm breaking balls, because I'm
uncomfortable. No, you know, I tell people 11 years, because the story wouldn't have been the same had I written it right after we came back from that deployment. So, I mean, soup to nuts, it took me about 1 year to write it. And then, you know how it is, find an agent and then a publisher. But, you know, the stories would not have been the same.
Why? That fascinates me.
Well, it takes people time to process things. And, you know, I did over 75 interviews with not only the Marines and the soldiers, but the families that are so important to this story. You know, when you lose brothers and sisters and sons and daughters, and you have to find a way to, you know, unpack some of that trauma that we experienced under the worst conditions that humanity has to offer, the worst that combat has to offer, because that city was just defined fighting for us. It was like the Super Bowl of combat because we were fighting 2, 3, 4, 5 times a day in direct contact with the enemy. And it was a very intense kinetic environment for these young men and women that they were subjected to. And so I say it took me 11 years.
I do understand what you mean because it's like from my own experience, I'm not keeping a scorecard here. If I wrote about Saturday Night Live within 3 years of leaving, he'd be like, fuck those guys, man. It's like, no, it was all right there for you, buddy.
Yeah.
I'm the guy that, you know, put the gum in the works. Me. Getting in my own way and stuff. So I understand that. And that's, did you feel like while you were in Iraq, Afghanistan, et cetera, like, I got to write this down to write a book? Or was it an entire thought after the fact? As it's happening, do you go, I got to write this down?
No, we absolutely was not even at the forefront of my mind writing a book about the experience. I kept journals. I've always been a note taker, always been a writer, artist, I guess. But, you know, I kept notes and I actually started writing the book in around 2009. And then someone jacks my car, my driveway, this, you know, nice area of town in, you know, Southern California, steals my computer, my hard drives, and personal notebook. So I was kind of devastated by that. And then I was in this funk. I mean, they stole like 30,000 words. So I'm thinking, at the time, it was the best book I was writing. And so a year goes by, and then the Marines are calling me, "Hey, sir, how's the book coming? How's the book coming?" I'm like, "Great, great." Totally lying to him. Yeah, like, hadn't written a word. I was just completely devastated. And
of course, yeah.
So I waited, and then I retired from the Marine Corps. I worked up here in L.A. for a little bit in the private sector, and then just decided to move to my ranch in Temecula and lock myself in my room for a year. And the book just really became different because of those interviews and the things I got. When I call a guy like Sergeant Espinoza, who I write about in the book, and he wasn't real chatty Cathy, but when I finally shut up and just sat there and typed, the stories that came out were things that were not even known to me at the time when we were fighting in Iraq, because you're managing the lives of over 250 Marines, these young kids, and all the dynamics and dealing with the local Iraqi populace and all that pressure and that friction. To be able to get those stories 10 years later was probably, you know how they say, things happen for a reason. Well, I think that was a reason. And the book obviously turned out better in the end for me.
Major, it seems like, and I'm putting words in your mouth, you sort of had to get out of the way and let yourself look not through your lens.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, let Espinoza speak for Espinoza. Let, you know, Justin and his dad speak for each other. And that blew my mind. Justin and
Ryan and Kimberly.
The father and the son.
Yeah, that was Ryan Downing was my Marine. Justin was his brother, and his dad, Jeff.
Jeff and Justin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they were all in Iraq at the same time. And Kimberly's back home in Iowa, small town Iowa. And all three of our Marines are in Iraq in the infantry fighting at the same time.
Hold this thought, because like the fact that the son is giving advice to the father and the way you, yeah, it made me cry. I was on an airplane. I just like, it's just the way it just ended the chapter. I mean, I'm getting choked up now, like just like life. It just ended. I was like, you didn't make a meal out of it. It just ended. It was perfect. So I want to ask you about them, and a bunch of other things. As usual, friends, go to the Patreon page at jmoore.com. It seems really odd to be like, give us money after we talk about the Marine Corps, Semper Fi. We're going to fix a little bit of the copy. Brad Hutching, thank you for that, brother, because it does read a little bit like, if you guys don't donate, it's all over. You keep it afloat or we're out or we die. Not the case. We'll be around. You could just help us out with, you know, stuff, mics. I mean, maybe we can get a talent booker one day. We've been doing really good. Actually, probably better than any podcast on earth without it. Break It Down show got Sly Stone. He didn't know he was on it, but good Lord.
Yeah.
So hit the Patreon at jmoore.com. You can, there's different levels. You get early releases of the interviews. You know, I'll write you a card, things of that nature. Help it out. Hook it up. Give a dollar. How many people can give 50 cents? That's what I want to see. True Car, my friends. How about this? True Car will help you get a used car. That's my route. I'm telling you, don't just get new cars. You got to get pre-owned vehicles. 600 miles on a car takes off like $10,000. It's pretty amazing. And True Car users like me, we save over $3,000 off MSRP. Manufacturers suggested retail price. You believe the balls on these people, Scotty?
That's nuts.
Well, we suggest it sells for your sister's ass and book of stamps, 50. Like, no. Half the stuff is like stuff that they got to fix behind the scenes before you even get there. True Car, you're going to lock in what you want to pay. They're going to let you know when that car is available. It's happened to me twice. Save time, save money, never overpay. I'm telling you, put my name on it. True Car. Major Scott Husing, Echo and Ramadi. Ramadi, is Iraq's deadliest city. What is it about Ramadi that made the Iraqi people just defend it like Chosin or like Khaisan? And
well, those are some good comparisons. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book as well, was Ramadi was such a significant battle, especially in 2006, but it really started that fight in 2004.
Yeah, like when you go from battle to, uh-oh, because a battle doesn't last 2 years.
You wouldn't think.
Right. So is there a different term? And I did interrupt you on purpose. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. But like to hear you call it a battle, I'm like, really?
Yeah, I don't think there's any time frame where you can say this battle lasted for a day or a week I'm trying to redefine that because I really do think it was a 2-year fight right. for that city as the capital of Alambar province. And, you know, we're talking about a city, Jay, that's 300,000 people, and the Euphrates River cuts from east to west. The place looked like it had been standing at point blank with a double barrel shotgun for 10 years. And we're not only fighting a well-trained insurgent force, which was probably about 10% of that population. So 5% hardcore fighters and then another 5% of one of Pete's favorite words, who's in studio with us today, co-belligerents. So these were guys that wanted to just get in the fight.
Sounds like a lot of Berlinery.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Pete threw that one at me.
So, co-belligerents.
So you got about 10% of these people, and then the rest, these local Iraqis, they're just people. They're not collateral damage. I mean, they're husbands and wives, and they got kids, and they want to go to the soccer game on Saturday, but they couldn't because of the insurgency. It had been boiling over, and in 06, when we went back in during the surge strategy that George W. Bush and Dave Petraeus ordered, that was to really put the clamp on that city because we didn't want the city to fall. And guys like, you know, now...
Fall to whom?
To fall to the insurgency. Yeah.
Is that Saddam's insurgency or the insurgency
after? This is all post-Saddam. These are these Islamic factions that wanted to get
a lot of people listen. I just want to keep it on point here. Because a lot of... If I live there, you're the insurgency to me. If I live there, it's like, just get off my block, bro.
The best way to describe it is, you know, on a small American scale is any major gang within an urban area. Like if they wanted to take over, local businesses can't operate without, you know, threats of intimidation, right. fear, murder, kidnapping. And this is not urban legend, Jay. I mean, this is how these guys operated.
Yeah.
And
that happens in Manhattan. Like, hey, I'm your new trash man. Here's the new sticker on the door. Like, I know that.
Yeah.
So we have to clamp it down so the insurgents post-Saddam just don't run it. I mean, that's like we were talking off mic about Somalia. Just hunger was working for the drug lords, and we tried to do something about it and realized maybe we couldn't. So the same – is that similar – not the drug lords in Somali. I just let you continue. So we're trying to clamp down in Ramadi.
Yeah, the whole province of Alambar, which is, you know, the biggest province in Iraq – up until that point in 06 was like this giant game of whack-a-mole, as I describe it. You know, we'd hammer them down in Tikrit. We'd hammer them down in Baghdad. We'd hammer them down in cities like Fallujah, some of these more well-known battles. But in 06, Ramadi was one of the places we chose to fight. And because we flooded the battle space with tens of thousands of additional troops, that allowed us to cover down on every one of those cities instead of just hammering them down into fine powder, and then they'd kind of fade off, and then they'd pick and choose the cities they wanted to fight. Well, in 06 and 07... Ramadi is where they decided to make a stand, and they did. They fought, and they fought hard. We didn't underestimate them, but at the end of the day, they lost badly, because a lot of times I get asked, well, did we win? And that's a tough question to answer, and I know you didn't ask it, but a lot of people do. Well, you know, what is winning? You know, if it was killing bad guys, I mean, we're absolutely lighting up the scoreboard, and a lot of people didn't see that end of it. The other metric of success for me as a commander, as a leader,
your guys,
is bringing as many guys home alive as possible.
That's It seems I brought this up with Pete Turner. I brought this up with Nate Boyer, Johnny Walker. It seems like, well, and forgive me because I am a Luddite when it comes to information about the region, about history, about it, and I wasn't there. This is a hornet's nest that got kicked over millennia ago, like pre-Bible. And it feels like and Pete knows my history. I'm down the line pro-you, pro-us, what's right is right. Like Kennedy's inauguration speech, like you got to pick up the torch for freedom for people that can't do it for themselves. Like I'm in. But it seems like just our presence becomes its own hornet's nest. Where I tried to oversimplify it with Pete Turner, like, but if we leave, it all goes away. And he just absolutely rejected it outright. Like, that would be the crazy. I'm like, well, we weren't there before we went there. And it was crazy. That's got to be very trying on your psyche as you're commanding 250 men getting shot at every day. Because I would think eventually you go, you know, we could just go backwards and get out of here with our dignity. Healthy.
Well, we didn't obviously have that luxury as guys fighting, because you know, we're not fighting politics. We're not fighting strategy or policy. We're fighting the enemy. That's what the Marines were doing. And the Army brothers we fought alongside.
I can say it more succinctly, and I apologize.
No.
The enemy's only there because you're there.
Yeah, well, they were still there, but again, we were there to not only kill the enemy. I mean, our mission was clear, kill or capture anti-Iraqi forces. But we did that through a lot of things, through our presence. And you know the Marines do a lot of things great. You know, they shoot the rifle straight at anybody and attack and kill the enemy. But they also help those that can't help themselves. And that's what they were doing as they fought amongst the people. I mean, literally, street to street, house to house, we would encounter local Iraqis. And for the most part, they were good, peace-loving people that wanted to help us and provide information if they could. Sometimes they gave us food or hot chai. And, you know, they wanted stability. And I think that because there was no infrastructure in the country of Iraq, there was no real political system in place, there was absolutely no functioning police. It was really a puppet force. And even their military, which was still fledgling, they just didn't have those things. So back to your original question is, you know, why do we stay? Why do we go? Why do we leave? I don't think any of us needed a crystal ball to look in and say, oh, if we don't plant a proverbial flag here in Iraq, we're going to be back in 10 years. And look at your history books. May 2015, where did ISIS take over? Ramadi.
Yeah. Where there are military bases, Japan, Italy,
Germany. Yeah, and so we weren't really good students of our history.
If you're listening to this, when you have grandchildren, we will be in Ramadi.
Well,
period.
It was a great point. We weren't good students of our history. We haven't been to model what we did in the European theater, what we did in the Pacific theater. And sometimes it takes 50 years for that to happen. But we as an American culture want everything fast, right? We're a fast food nation, fast cash, fast gas.
It's the Snapchat.
Snapchat.
Catch it.
Twitter. Oh, he didn't reply to my text in, you know, 2 seconds. We want everything. So we want fast democracy too. And we haven't made a commitment over there to say, hey, this is what right looks like. And
you really helped me just by saying anti-Iraqi forces, because Johnny Walker really cleaned my head on the fact that he lived in Mosul and they were so in love with the fact that we had come in to actually liberate Mosul. I thought it was all bullshit. I railed against the TV, the programs, everything I was ever told. I was like, come on, bro. And Johnny Walker's like, you don't know what the fuck you're talking. Essentially, you have no idea what the fuck you're talking about. Like, I was tortured and beaten. Like, thank God you guys showed up. And that was an education for me. So once we come in and we actually liberate where we liberate, then there's anti-Iraqi people, because the instability, I'm not educating you, obviously, for the listeners. Anti-Iraq instability tilts the tables towards the crooked. You need a crooked table if you're a crooked person. So that's then, it makes perfect sense to me now why you're in Ramadi fighting who you're fighting. I'm just letting you know, I've closed that bubble for myself.
Close the loop on that.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, makes perfect sense.
You're describing like Cleveland. Like, I'm not making a joke about Cleveland being a shithole, because I love Cleveland. Like, giant river, there's commerce that goes through the Euphrates.
Yeah.
300,000 people, once incredibly proud. It's like, oof, factory of sadness.
And they are a really proud culture. I mean, they've been around, as you said, for 5,000 plus years compared to our meager 250 plus year existence. So again, trying to impose our type of democracy or just some form to show them what right looks like is really going to be the future if we're really going to see progress. And, you know, we're talking about Johnny Walker and guys like Pete who's sitting here that have been in Iraq. They totally get this when we talk about what it takes to make a change and these people that have sacrificed. And, you know, Johnny's a good example. And there's a whole chapter in Echo and Ramadi about my interpreters, these young Iraqi kids who really risked everything, sacrificed their own lives, their family's safety to help the coalition forces, because they were having the insurgents come in, trash their house, burn it to the ground. They burned their grandma's Volvo out. I mean, what?
Those motherfuckers.
Insurgents hate safe vehicles. They hate safety. I mean, they're haters of everything, even Volvos. So nothing was off limits. I mean, this came from one of my young kids. He's 18, 19-year-old skinny Iraqi Terp. And by the way, I'm flying to Tampa next week, and he's getting sworn in as an American citizen. How cool is that?
It's really cool.
Very cool.
There's a lot of roosters walking around on the streets. Do you know that?
No.
Call me by surprise. I'm not joking. There's cock everywhere. I put it on my Instagram. I want you to talk. Route Trans Am just seemed like, well, Jeff and Justin is where we left before True Car. This, a father and son, was so incongruous to me that I kept going back and starting their story again. And obviously it tracks. I'm not going to do it any justice with stupid questions. Could you just explain the situation?
You're throwing big words out, like Luddite, incongruous. Like, there's a lot of big words being said.
Incongruous. I'm going to go in the swimming pool. Where's my tuxedo?
Way above
tuxedo
my level.
And swimming pool are incongruous. You know? Bathing suit and...
Yeah. No. Well, you're talking to a guy that graduated high school with a 1.24 GPA. Like,
I think
which I'm not even... Is that graduating? Or they're like, no, you can just join the Marine Corps. Join the Marine Corps.
It didn't make sense to me that a father and a son were serving together.
Yeah. All three of them in the Marines.
And the third, I got confused. Kimberly?
Yeah, well, no. Justin, Ryan, and Jeff Downing are all three Marines.
Oh, all right.
So. All three infantry guys and all in Iraq at one point at the same time. And they're... Mom and wife, Kimberly, is back in
Ireland.
That's
right. Okay.
Yeah. So
that's when I was speaking.
And
reading.
That's why the chapter in Ikrimah is called Sacrifice. Because if you really want a true definition of that word sacrifice, talk to Kimberly Downing, you know, who sacrificed all three of her sons to go over there and serve our country. They're all doing great now. Again, all great success stories. You know, Ryan's a full-time cop now in Iowa. And, you know, he's got.
Hi, Ryan. And Kel Sanderson's better than Dan Gable. So who was Kimberly's husband?
Jeff.
Okay, thanks.
Jeff.
I'm just going to read this. It's brief.
Read it. But I think the listeners should know, too, you texted me this morning and said you didn't finish the whole book. And I meant to send him the first edition autographed copy of Cliff Notes for Echo and Ramadi, which might have gotten you through this a little quicker.
No, I'm glad it's the way it is because we can do this again. It's too big to like Longest Day.
Yeah,
you can't.
It's not a it's not a dictionary. I don't want listeners to think like this book.
No.
I'm not that smart either.
It's just like when I read Black Hawk Down. These were extraordinary men, and these are incredibly real people.
Mark Bowden did a good job.
I could feel who's that?
Mark Bowden did a good job of that story as well.
Like, I knew what the living room was felt like, smelt like. I knew what the light looked like when they were kids. I mean, that's what you've done here, man. Like, you knocked me on my ass. I texted Pete the other day, like, I'm halfway through this book, man. I didn't bring it to Maine with me, otherwise I'd be done with it. I was kicking myself. I had to read the AA Big Book like a jerk. Hey, it's Jay Moore. Help my podcast stay free to download with minimal ads. Wait, this doesn't even fucking make sense. It is free to download. Like they're going to start charging people. There's the More Stories app. This is weird. Don't forget to get my app.
I'm going to do it. I was just thinking about getting that. Yeah,
their app is great, Podcast One.
I was scrolling through the pages. It was like everybody in their fucking podcast.
No.
Podcast. I just saw that.
Yeah.
They're just saying to subscribe so they can keep it free because if they subscribe, then you get
Got it. So I'll take the onus off of me.
Right.
Podcasts are the best. I'm telling you. Once you dig a podcast or two, you don't care about traffic, and they're free. That's right. Download them for free. Listen to them on airplanes. Minimal ads. All you got to do, if you want to keep that going, how about this? How about you take a survey? It takes maybe 5 minutes. I took it. Podcastone.com/mysurvey. Can you remember that? Podcastone.com/mysurvey. Just go to podcastone.com. They have hoarded all the phenomenal podcast like More Stories. I'm going to be done with this because I got to listen to Shaq Daddy break it down. That's what's up. Jordan Harbinger. Take it, folks. Let's go. Podcast One Survey. Please take it. Love you guys. 14th of September 2004, Jeff and Justin crossed paths in Kuwait at the MNF's vast intermediate staging base where coalition troops and equipment flowed in and out of the theater of operations. Jeff bounced from tent to tent, asking strange Marines where Fox Company, 2nd Battalion, 7th Marines was, trying to track down his son. Jeff and Justin finally reunited, and they visited for a few hours as they ate pizza at the dining facility. Against the natural order of things, the son now gave the father advice, raiding a can of his dad's Copenhagen snuff as he did, The other Marines from Jeff's squad sat at the table and listened intently to the conversation. Jeff paid close attention to his son's advice. Rank and experience played little part in a wartime education in Iraq, since dynamics on the battlefield changed so quickly. As Justin and Jeff parted, the son said to his father, "Keep your head down, Dad. It's a fucking shithole over there." When Justin returned home a few months later, he told his mom how scared he was for his dad's safety. Justin knew firsthand how brutal things had become in Iraq. The situation was worsening, and every Marine was either fighting or preparing to fight. He said that he was afraid that the all-too-quick meeting they shared was the last time he'd see his father alive. The actual pages got torn up there. There's, like, in that, those three paragraphs, I could unpack this for a month. Hmm. Strange Marines. He's asking strange Marines. I know what you mean, but I could read into it. I mean, we look like Tron when we go over there.
Yeah, like I use that fucking analogy a lot. Like, we look like spacemen. Yeah, we do.
Against the natural order of things is something Wally Lamb would write. It's just, I don't know. Like, his dad's Copenhagen. I just imagine how many times the father was like, "Don't do this stuff that I do, man." And it's just game on. Were there moments when you wrote this book where you just break down? I mean, this, like, I'm reading it breaking down.
Yeah, there were some tough points. I mean, I don't ever say I had a massive catharsis after I wrote the end. I mean, obviously, if you read the last chapter, well, no, I'd like to think that I'm authentic. You write and share so many other people's stories. And when you do the phone calls, and yeah, there's some heartening moments, and there's some tough phone calls I had to make. And there was also a point where...
Your first one made me cry.
It makes me cry when I think about it. When I speak about it, it's tough stuff. But those are the stories that need to be told to really honor what our young men and women sacrifice for our country. And I think those are important stories. And, you know, I probably called a dozen, if not 100 times, to Jenny Libby or Nikki and Bob Litke, and I said, "Hey, is it all right for me to share this story? Are you sure you want me to tell it?" And every single phone call I made, they said, "Yes, tell the story," because that's how we continue to honor those that gave everything.
That's what was so disarming in the first chapter, called "Phone Call," was how solicitous the mom was and how much she thanked you for just being a stand-up guy and calling.
Who does that? Where do these people come from? They're just extraordinary people. It's the only word out of the entire book I could use to describe our gold star families. Extraordinary people.
Can you tell the listeners basically chapter one?
Chapter one is called "Phone Call" because it describes the heart-wrenching phone call I had to make to the mother of a Marine, Corporal Dustin Libby, that we lost in a grueling 5-hour firefight on December 6, 2006. And, you know, you just don't get any training for that. They tell you to write a letter of condolence, but I know I wouldn't want a letter of condolence. It wouldn't be enough for me. And to have to dial the number and speak to the mother of a Marine who literally died hours before, who was standing, you know, right beside you, fighting to protect his brothers, and then died. There's no easy way to do it. Pete and I were talking about it on the way up here. Is like, who's had to make that phone call? Have you ever had to call somebody? I mean, have you ever had to call a friend or a family member and say, "Hey"?
Oh, I've done it. Yeah, I'm like the Grim Reaper. I'm always the guy that go like, "So and so died, and I got to go tell the rest of the family." And like, I carry that. I'm not comparing at all what you went through, but it's like I hold in my brain life and death, and I'm about to change the trajectory of everybody's life by saying, "Hey, your mom died," or "Hey, this happened or that happened."
Yeah.
So Corporal Libby dies, and his mom lives where?
Castle Hill, Maine. So I called her, and then not only did she thank me for calling and, you know, told us she loved us, you know, after I called, but then I had to, you know, she handed the phone over to Judd, his dad, and then his brother Chris, And, you know, I still talk to them. I'm still very connected to all these people to this day, which is really, I think, if anyone ever asked me, that's the core message of this book, is the power of human connection.
Absolutely.
It's not,
absolutely,
it's not a war story. It's a story about people who fought at war in one of the bloodiest cities and one of the bloodiest battles in modern urban history. But the power of human connection, that we're still so inextricably connected to these families and the Marines who fought. And yeah, that develops through shared loss, through shared sacrifice. But I'm also very honored that they still call me and ask, you know, view me as their leader, because my leadership didn't stop when I left from Adi, Jay. It didn't stop in 2013 when I retired from the Marine Corps. It is what really sustains me to this day, to have those phone calls and these young warriors who are now 30 something and say, hey, can I get a letter of recommendation? I'm applying to the police department or grad school, or my interpreter invites me out to his swearing in ceremony as American citizen, to be viewed as their leader to this day. That's something that you don't seek as a leader, that type of, I guess, validation. But yeah, to know that that's there is something remarkable to me. I'm very honored to still be able to do
that. You should be, and you nailed it. It's not a war book. It's not a war story. It's just, that's the backdrop. It's like you go see a play and they just paint a city behind the windows, or like in a sitcom, they just paint Seattle on Frasier, they paint fucking San Francisco on, you know, whatever, and it just it takes place in Ramadi and other places. But you nailed it. It's human connection. And as you said that, and everybody listening, go buy this book. Like, this is the one. Like, this is it. I have never steered you guys wrong. It's so goddamn, oof. It's powerful, man. And if you're a sensitive cat like me, Mike and Fresno and Landon, you could sit there and cry in a Chase Lounge because people think you're reading about firefights and not about, you know, Major hiding between two Jeeps because he's breaking down crying, calling Mrs. Libby. Is it possible that as overwhelming was the death of, well, nothing's as overwhelming as the death, your first loss, Corporal Libby from Maine, her kindness back filling that container felt to me like wind going in a sail in the wrong direction, and just the entire boat is different. Like, it just, that had to have been unexpectedly overwhelming.
Yeah.
Almost, I would say, from humiliatingly so. Not humiliating, like, you have anything to be ashamed of. Like, for me personally, like, oh, like, stop. Like, what is she doing? Like, how is this happening?
It's,
like, she went to let you off the hook.
Exactly, because she understood that Dustin, like everyone who fought, loved being a Marine more than anything. And he loved being around his brothers. And we're all brothers. We have this shared fraternity that is so unbreakable. It's not just some bumper sticker or a t-shirt, and that ethos that we share of honor, courage, and commitment to each other is everlasting. It really is. And when she said that to me, you're shifting gears constantly. I mean, literally, we were just in a five-hour firefight, slugging it out. The whole city was boiling over that night, literally.
You have paperwork. Like, you literally probably have paperwork to do. Do you like paperwork after a firefight?
No.
Oh, okay.
Not a lot of paperwork. Yeah, going.
Thank you.
On
okay, good. Point. Like, yeah, cops, yeah, making arrests are like, shit, and I'll be up.
No, there. No, not
okay,
even.
Okay, so please,
not even close. Just, yeah,
there's a lot of stuff going on. Like,
yeah,
you said,
we're, you know, constantly.
You're
engaged.
Down a man.
Yeah, we're down a man. There's several other guys wounded in the company. The Army's suffering heavy casualties to the south of Route Michigan and the Malab. It literally was like a pot boiling over on your stove, Jay. Like, I don't know what kind of chili you cook, but could you imagine it just spilling into the burners and you can't shut the gas off? That's what the city felt like that night. And for most nights, it was constantly boiling over, and there was nothing we could do about it but fight back. And I think Jenny Libby knew that, and she knew what a horrible place it was that we were fighting in. And she was a mom, and she
that
treated
speaks
us
to the human
all
connection to, like, the departed.
Yeah.
He's very much alive, because when you're speaking with her, the way she's treating you is the way he spoke about you, the way he feels currently right now about you. That's powerful, man. Like, she filled you with love because he filled her with love because he loved the Marines. She loved him. Like, this doesn't end. It's like a nuclear sub. This will go around the earth and it'll never stop. That, I mean, this book really took me out, bro. And I know what you mean about like the pot boiling over. And I'm like, at what point in this firefight, when you know that Corporal Libby's down, it just seemed cruel that you have to make that phone call. That you can't delegate it, but I know you would not. You personally would never delegate that to somebody else.
No.
I mean, that's your first loss.
Yeah.
Is it instantaneous? Like, oh, get him over here. I got to call his mom. Like,
no,
it just
the phone
like-
call didn't happen until several hours after we were able to get back, and the fighting had died down that next morning when we really found out that Corporal Libby didn't make it. And, you know, there's so many elements to that story. One of them was recently shared with me. I got to share this with you because you'll appreciate this.
Please.
Is I got
less me, more you. Good.
I like more you, less me.
They don't. But,
okay. So I receive an email from a soldier through my website at Echo and Ramadi, and he says...
Echoandramadi.com?
Echoandramadi.com. You can see some pictures of Corporal Libby and all the other Marines at the site. But I get this email from Staff Sergeant Phil Morehouse, and he writes, "Dear sir, I'm probably pretty sure that you don't even remember me, but I was in the combat outpost the night Corporal Libby was shot, and I remember the call on the radio, and I raced across the street to the battalion aid station, and I remember standing there, and I remember your convoy rolling in through the maze of chem lights, and I can remember the sound of the brakes and the dust cloud that surrounded the vehicles, and I can remember your Marines carrying Corporal Libby. I remember the look on their faces, and I remember the look on your face, and I remember every single step you took that night. And those are things I haven't thought about in almost 12 years. And he goes on in the email to say some other stuff, but he ends by saying, yes, we definitely made a difference. And to see that reflection from somebody's eyes that was there watching what I was doing and going through and experiencing, that's pretty powerful reflection. And to have him share that story with me is just one example of...
You never would have had that lens. It's
never.
Like Doc peeing on the tires after the IED explosion. It's just like everyone's all jangled and freaked out. And you're like, I just take the piss.
Yeah.
It was Doc, right?
It was, I think, one of the other Marines.
It was one of you guys. Like, everyone's like freaked out because you guys hit an IED patch.
Yeah, they all survived.
Like, on Trans Am? No, it was Doc. Doc stood outside the Humvee unfazed and relieved himself on the front tire despite the madness that was unfolding around him. It's just like, there's a fight. He's like Duval in Apocalypse Now.
there are parts that you probably picked up on. Some things you read and you think, oh, that's just like it happens in the movies. And then there's other parts you read and you understand it's nothing like they portray in the movies. It's as unvarnished as it gets. That's the way I wanted to write it.
Well, what's the movie based on? The movie's based on, like, I remember this one guy we served with was like this. Put him in your movie. You know, it's not like Stripes. I wanted to go in the Army when I was a kid because my parents let me see Stripes. And I'm like, I get to spy on girls washing their tits.
Who would you have been? What character in Stripes?
Oh,
Zitsky? Winger?
I'd be...
Pete, give me a ruling on who Jay would be in Stripes.
Yeah, I'll defer.
John
Lithgow was very good in Stripes.
John Larroquette.
Wash those boobies. Winger, I notice you're always last.
Are those my men? Those are fine-looking men.
No, those are your men, sir.
Yeah.
Doctor said I ought to swallow a lot of aggression, along with a lot of pizzas. This email got to me, and I wanted to share with you from John Creighton. Hey, Pete, you listen to this. Fuck it. I just filled out that stupid form. Would it be possible to get Mr. Moore for an interview? No, fuck you, John Creighton. Like, what fucking crazy form does he have to email me? It's the most basic any website on earth. You have to go through these. That's his entire. Look at it. John Creighton. Fuck it. I just filled out that stupid form. Would it be possible to get Mr. Moore for an interview? It doesn't say what it's for. Like, I'm just going to write back, like, of course, baby, bubby, baby.
You never say no to an opportunity. That's what sets you apart from others.
I say no to this interview, but I'm still going to use his name as content. I think you'll dig this one. Barry Covington, JJ, email me morestories3737@gmail.com. I wanted to see if you wanted to come to my birthday party this year. I'm a pretty normal guy. I live in Pittsburgh. I'm 33. I would love to have you for my birthday party in May. I'd pay for you and one other person to fly to Pittsburgh to come to my birthday party at my house. We can barbecue, play croquet. You can meet my dad. He's pretty normal too. Attached is a picture of me and him from this summer. If you're interested, my number is below, so you can call me and see how regular I am, and my father is as well. I know you're a busy guy. No hard feelings if you can't make it. There's always next year. Barry Covington. Guess what? Him and his dad look entirely cool, and I'm mad I was late on this email. I want to go to this guy's birthday next year.
Do normal people invite you to play croquet? Is that I think that's a question.
One? Yeah, you were the first guy I thought of, actually.
Pete loves croquet.
And plus one.
Pete's a big plus one guy, but croquet is like such an odd, specific thing to put in this email.
You
like,
have to be a real fan of croquet. It's a lost art form.
Barry Covington's a croquet motherfucker, man. Yeah. Him and his old man. I bet his old man hustles me for money on croquet. He's probably like one of those golf guys who go like, hey, you got a really nice grip. Like when you're up by two strokes, you're like, ah, the whole game comes apart. You're thinking about your hands. It's probably one of the, it's croquet's like polo without the horse, right?
I don't know.
Hey, Barry, tell your old man I'm going to bury him in croquet. Yeah, I'll come next year. We missed it, Petey.
Oh, damn it.
But that was like the coolest thing ever. Like, hey, I'll pay your airfare. Will you want to come?
You never miss an opportunity. But they'll probably still have you, though.
What he said,
the party over.
There's always next year because I can't go now. I got two kids. But here's the thing, Barry. You can never tell any of your friends that you just reach out to me in the email on the website. Like, no, me and JJ have known each other forever. Like, be as ambiguous as possible. Like, how the fuck do you know Jay Moore? Like, you know Jay too. Like you. Oh, you don't know JJ. JJ, how do you guys know each other? It's like, oh no, me. Hey, Pete, Barry, we just know each other. Like, God. We know each other. Yeah, just like that's the whole gag for me. That's what makes me happy. Yeah, Barry, I want to go. Barry Covington. When you mentioned Maine, I was in Maine last weekend. It seems like a very disproportionate amount of soldiers come from Maine in every single conflict. The Civil War had 70,000 soldiers. There couldn't have been more than 150,000 people in the state then. 50% of Maine's budget went to the Civil War. Maine. Vietnam, like, whoosh, the names have come out of Maine. It made me cry. I was in a car service just looking, like, I just started crying. I looked at my girlfriend. I'm like, this is crazy. Just... all corporals.
Yeah.
I can't figure it out. It's not poor. It's not.
I don't know. I think they're just good Americans up there, maybe in New England, you know, that they.
I mean, obviously.
Obviously. We had a pretty big Texas contingent in my company.
Texas guys,
a lot of Texas guys. A lot of California guys. A lot of Illinois guys where I was born.
Where were you born?
Illinois.
Joliet?
Waukegan.
No, man, we're on a mission from God. What's the one state where you're like, I never had one soldier from Rhode Island, like something weird?
Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot. There's probably a lot like that.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Best nickname I ever heard for a patrol guy was Krzyzewski or something. They just called him I-Chart.
Yeah.
Because he had so many letters in his name when I was on the Greenville in Pearl Harbor. And like, when do you go talk to I-Chart over there? And I looked at his name tag and went, oh my God. and you informed me that guys like me, we humps, we don't get patrol nicknames. Your name is fucking a dog shit. Go do that for me. Because he got me a hat that said Whizzer on it.
Yeah, that was a bad call sign.
Hey, I wear that. It's better than the one that says Jay Moore on the back walking to the airport. You know, hey, that's Jay Moore, I guess. Oh, yeah, it says it on the back of his United States Army hat. Cool, dick. He wasn't in the Army. I'd much rather it say Whizzer.
Did anyone thank you for your service?
Or not? No, no. Yes, but not in that way.
Yeah.
I can't tell you. I'm so glad you're writing another book. I'm so glad you're doing your speaking engagements, echoandramati.com. Literally once a month for the next year, I'll never run out of things to ask. I've asked you 4 questions total. I'm be honest with you. I'm still a little overwhelmed by the book. That's why I tried to push it today. But then I realized I can't ask a major of the United States Marines, like, could you give me another day so I could chill out? You've been in a few firefights.
I would have done it for you, Jay.
No, you wouldn't, because I emailed you twice and you said no.
You emailed me at 2:30 in the morning, which is not
I masturbate past my constantly, work day. Okay? Exactly. I have a problem.
That does not meet the commander's waiting criteria, by the way.
Well, send me to the head shed, man. I got a
the
problem.
Jay Moore alarm did not go off on my iPhone. Sorry.
That's a damn
sorry
shame.
Sorry to hurt your feelings. I know
you're incapable,
sensitive
hey.
Sally, but
my man. Yeah. Scott, you're incapable of hurting my feelings. In war, destruction is everywhere. It eats everything around you. Sometimes it eats at you. That's such a great quote. I couldn't believe it was just yours. It seems like something from almost medieval times.
Most people can't believe that.
I mean, it's just perfect. Not because you couldn't come up with a great quote, but it just seems like Sun Tzu or something. It does eat at you, I would assume, of course. And you look entirely together. So whatever mental program you have that you're doing, I'm so glad you're doing it, man.
Yeah.
I mean, I love you forever. That's straight up, dude.
Nah, I appreciate it.
Anytime, any place.
Yeah.
I'm not a soldier, but you need something, I'll do it.
Well, it's because of people like you and Pete and Nate and Johnny and all these great supporters of veterans. And I don't care what side of the aisle you're on or how you casted ballots. It has nothing to do with any of that because we're all about supporting veterans and understanding that it's through this network is just one small piece. And a portion of the proceeds of my book go to help savethebrave.org, which helps veterans with post-traumatic stress. And every podcast we share fellow authors with or artists or whatever your bag is, that helps. That's a way to help. So we were talking about that before we even went on the air is donating services, donating money. There's all these different ways. And I think that's a beautiful thing that I've really been exposed to over the past just like 3 months since we launched a book is this network of people, how we're so connected. And you really think you're never
like
going to be
the people in the book.
Yeah. And when you're on active duty in the military, you never think you're going to be as protected or that brotherhood is never going to be as strong. But when you leave, especially for a guy like me after 24 years, if you allow yourself to move outside of your network, outside of your comfort zone, and I'm not saying everyone has to share their soul and write a book about it or stand in front of 500 people and speak about it either. But if you allow yourself to be exposed, again, like you, I don't ever try and miss an opportunity either because I never know who I'm going to meet. And it's through that connection where it brought people like Pete into my life, people like you, Corey, these three attack dogs that are circling your apartment here.
Where did I get my coonhound in here, bro?
They are crazy.
Sounds like Jay Coker at the 50-yard line. We are good team out
there. There was a lot of things that frightened me in Ramadi, but these hounds you have here are...
Release the hounds.
Yes.
Nate brought to my attention 22kill.com. Like you're saying, anybody out there, if you're a barber, free haircuts. If you're a dentist, just work on a dude's teeth, man. Just, you know, put it on the arm. These guys need your help. And I need to say this emphatically. Nobody on God's green earth joins the service because they want to go kill brown people. Nobody. Nobody in the history of the service said, wait till I get in there, go somewhere else, and end the life of somebody else. No. So for those of you like maybe on the fence about getting involved, these are people that are very patriotic on one end, people that are very destitute and really have no other way out. They can, if you ain't got a jump shot, you ain't slinging rock, bingo, you're the guy. And you're trained and you're trained and you're trained and you're trained until it's a reflexive memory, your muscles, your body. These are extraordinary people. And this book, Echo and Ramadi, oof, man, I'm getting choked up now.
Yeah.
Black Hawk Down is the best analogy. Like, forget about the movie if you're listening. The book was so, like, I knew these dudes. Like, I grew up with these dudes.
Yeah.
Like, when the Delta op gets shot, it's like, well, if he gets fucking shot, what chance do I have? He's a Delta op. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was so personal in my neighborhood for some reason. And that's what you've done. This is my absolute favorite book of the year. Nothing.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, it's incredible, Scott. Like, yeah. I'm really, you've seen me a lot, Corey. Like, this is, it's overwhelming. So I'd love to have you back when I get my shit together. No, and talk more specifically about getting choked up.
Yeah. No, I think that's really what it was about for me, was the emotion and the pain and the feeling, and not just the firefights and the excitement and that sexy stuff that's in there, but really learning about the people. And I don't know where I got that from, but capturing that type of texture where you can feel the moment or you can smell that, to write about what something smells like. I think those words you use, and Bowden's another great writer who captured that. And when I never used to be one of those guys that said, the book's so much better. Because true confession, I think it's on Pete's show, was I didn't read my first book cover to cover until I was a Lance Corporal in Operation Desert Storm.
What was the book?
It was Guns Up by John.
Peter North.
No, it wasn't Peter North. But true confession, and it was probably out of sheer boredom. And you know, I was mocking you earlier in jest. But I geeked my way through high school probably on Cliff Notes. I'm not kidding. I didn't grow up in a family where my mom read to me every night. I mean, I came from, you know, divorced home, broken home. Like many guys in the military, and you seek out that family. But to be able to write those pieces in there and capture, I think, is something that I would agree is makes this different to understand.
Right. I just opened. You just saw me open this randomly, right? Mm-hmm. There's no marks on this page. As the casket was carried aboard, the Marines formed on the tarmac near the rear of the aircraft to salute their departing brother. As the ramp began to rise slowly, the Marines dropped their salutes but remained standing sharply in formation until the ramp closed. It was and is one of the most moving moments to witness. I'll never know love like that.
Yeah, total strangers. From the point of injury, when that Marine or soldier falls, and the way that they're handled was something, again, that was unknown to me until I did that interview with Mike Perkins, and he shared that as a KC-130 pilot, because you really just have blind faith in the system, like your guys are going to be taken care of.
My family is in that aluminum gasket. Yeah. Like not like a dude I know. Like I get as much as I can get it, Scott. That's all I can tell you, Major.
Yeah.
How do you say this last name? You lost 10 men in how many years?
We lost 3 from Echo Company, and I honor all of the guys we lost in Ramadi.
So 10 in the book.
In the battalion, lost. We lost.
Litke? Yeah.
Corporal Simon Litke, we actually lost after the battle in November of 2015 to suicide. And we've lost several others since then. And like you said, you know, this isn't some Facebook push-up challenge, Jay. These are real people.
Yes, sir.
I mean, I talked to Nikki Licky yesterday, and this being the week just after Memorial Day that we're recording this, I wrote an article on Fox News, an op-ed, about Nikki Licky and about Simon Licky, because we need to honor those guys that were continuing to fight that battle long after they left the battlefield and took their own lives. And I think they're important stories, and it's tough to hear, you know.
They are. I mean, and I don't know how many more of us
saw. None of us saw it coming when we lost Simon, but you know, there's sad parts of it, but there's also this brightness that it still brings us together, and his family's still connected to
us. There's a beautiful humanity to all this, and your next book, like, it doesn't have to be about war at all. Like, you're really onto something that, like, Buddhists try to transcend to get to. The space between us isn't empty. Namaste, the divinity in me respects the divinity in you. Like, you got that. You get it. I put my name on it, Echo and Ramadi. Major Scott Husing. Thank you, brother.
Well, thanks for having me on the program. All more stories. Love it. Love to be back anytime.
Corporal Simon R. Litke. Corporal Andrew W. Marari. Lance Corporal Stephen M. Chavez. Sergeant Clinton W. Alquist. Sergeant Major Joseph J. Ellis. Corporal Richard O. Quill III. Lance Corporal Anthony C. Malia. Lance Corporal Andrew G. Mattis. Lance Corporal Emilian D. Sanchez. Corporal Dustin J. Libby.
Those are the heroes.